This program is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners. Show your support at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This week on Meet and Three, we're looking at things that have changed and things that are still in flux. From mothers balancing new lifestyles to the social stigma surrounding pumpkin spice.
You got rid of the star rating system and talked about, like, I'm not going to use the word ethnic when I talk about food.
They recognized that safety was our motivation, and they were very, you know, receptive to the changes, understanding what we were trying to accomplish.
A cupcake or a piece of bacon or a glass of rosé is not inherently gendered.
Tune in to Meet and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Corey Rateau, Senior Category Manager at Good Eggs, the e-commerce grocery business beloved by so many people in the Bay Area. While I love talking to founders on this podcast, I really love talking to grocery buyers because I often feel like we miss the point a little bit. Our job isn't just to solve consumer problems, it's to support grocers too, if we're selling wholesale. So I'm thrilled, Corey, that you're here. You're going to break it down for us. And you are my 100th guest. So if there were balloons that I could have magically appear in your apartment, like fall on you right now and confetti, just picture it. So yay.
Yay, welcome, and thank you for having me, Ali. Wishing you virtual confetti and balloons on your end, too. Congratulations on 100. I was about to say 1,000. That would be, that would be a few more years before
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. A lot. Okay, well, I'm super psyched because, like I said in the intro, you know, I feel, and people who listen to this podcast have heard me say it before, I feel like somehow in the world of grocery, beauty, sort of that whole consumer packaged world, the emphasis has kind of shifted off of the grocery buyer. And in a lot of cases, unfortunately, it shifted to the founder or like the company, which I just think is a little bit of an error. But I think in this sort of like entrepreneurship is the new fill in the blank. Everyone's really excited to make products, and it is really fun seeing your products in the world. And of course, I think a lot of people want to make products to solve consumer problems. But the reality is if you are selling in a grocery store, it's not as simple as, you know, our cookie tastes really good, right? So I'm just really psyched that you're here, and I want you to tell me everything, like what you like, what you don't like, what you see that's working, what annoys you. But before we get into all that, I'm also really interested in how you got to this place in your career, because I think people that work in that world, I just find fascinating. And I'm just wondering, like, were you always a food person? Were you always that kid who loved the grocery store? What did you want to be? And tell me a little bit about you.
Absolutely. I would definitely consider myself a food person. And with that, going back to my childhood, have very fond memories of going to the grocery store. But when I was, say, maybe 9 or 10, I actually really wanted to become an architect. Mm-hmm. And so kind of when I was maybe 5, 6 years old, my mom and I moved to the San Francisco Bay Area. She had just finished her MBA, was kind of going out there with the dot-com boom, and kind of was a very involved kind of child in the courtship between her and my stepfather. And so he was an architect. And, you know, I thought he was super cool, someone I looked up to and, you know, really wanted to kind of follow in those footsteps. And so I appreciated the creativity of the, you know, kind of work that he was doing. We would build models together. And all in all, you know, always kind of having that kind of creative eye. Well, that sort of interest did wane. You know, I would consider myself always, you know, being very much inclined and excited about food. You know, I was a total latchkey kid, and one of the kind of earliest memories I have from, you know, that kind of new independence when I was a kid was the kind of one rule I had after I came home from school was that I couldn't use the stove. And so I remember this one time I was, you know, thought I was being clever by making mac and cheese, classic Kraft blue box in the microwave, except I put the pot in the microwave.
Rookie mistake, Corey, rookie mistake.
You have to learn from them. And so while I luckily didn't burn the house down, you know, I did definitely burn my hand quite badly on that pot. And you know, I'm glad it was just a physical scar and didn't turn me off, you know, from food.
I have a few of those. I have one where I wasn't allowed to use the oven, but I was allowed to use the stovetop. So I decided that I was nine, I think, or maybe eight. I decided I was going to roast corn on the stovetop, like on the burner. And so I tried to stab what turned out to be my mother's like fondue fork because it was 1981 or something. And I tried to stab it into the corn, but you know, on the thin side to, so that I could like roast it like a, you know, like over a fire,
like a skewer.
And I did like a skewer and I went right into my hand. And I couldn't decide whether I was more upset because I was gushing blood or because I was going to get in trouble when my parents came home and I was, you know, I bled all over the kitchen. But I think, you know, those of us who like loved making food or loved just wanted to get creative and play, we all have a burn or a scar or like, you know, something, my eyebrows singed at some point, you know, we all have them. So those are the things that, I don't know, make us die hard, I guess. And so, absolutely. So did you end up, you did not study architecture in school, but did you end up studying something related or engineering or anything in that world or no?
Yeah, so kind of fast forward to my high school years, and actually the day after I turned 16, I got my first grocery job. And so I was an after-school bag boy, and so that was definitely, you know, kind of, I think, following in my footsteps in an interest of, you know, exploring the grocery store, seeing what was on the shelf, having that additional layer of being able to see what people were putting into their baskets and kind of observing the habits and routines of our regular customers. And so that was definitely my first kind of, I guess, formal entry into grocery. And then I ended up in Chicago after I graduated high school. And at the time, you know, I envisioned myself kind of more along the lines of, you know, some sort of foreign service or other kind of international development, humanitarian aid, definitely, you know, kind of like, I guess, what was my maxim at that time? You know, like, think local, act global. And kind of with that too, always being very much, you know, anchored and oriented in community. And so I actually studied anthropology. And with that, you know, sort of this fascination between the individual and their community, vice versa. And, you know, kind of as I, you know, continued to grow up and, you know, go through school, really be able to understand the way that that food connects,
totally,
you know, kind of across those two on a very universal level.
Yeah.
And so, you know, was excited to, you know, go to the University of Chicago. It was like this very theoretical, you know, learning environment and space. But what I, you know, quickly discovered was that I am a much more applied and hands-on individual. I think that goes back to that, like, you know, the creativity of actually, you know,
right,
working with ingredients, you know,
making
cooking
models,
something, being able to, you know, share a meal with folks. And so kind of my time in Chicago overall was there for about 6 years.
Wow.
Only made it halfway through my degree program at the University of Chicago.
Right.
And there was kind of, during my time there, I lived, worked, and went to school on the same corner for five of those 6 years. And there was this small neighborhood market on this corner called Open Produce. And kind of with that, it was this really incredible space that had a little bit of everything for everyone from everywhere.
Yeah.
And so situated in such a, you know, kind of diverse community where you had, you know, long-term residents of the South Side, you had this ever kind of churning student populace, coupled with, you know, just this kind of, you know, working class base, being able to have a community-oriented market that, you know, was really targeting food access and, you know, being the only place after 10 p.m. in the entire neighborhood that you could get fresh produce. And kind of, you know, as I was going through my studies, I began working there as a night clerk. And so really tiny store, we're talking 700 square foot feet. We had like products so rolled away and all like the rafters. And with that, it was staffed by one individual for most hours of the day. And so kind of I would
relieve him,
work my shift, leave the store at 2 p.m. And with that, it was really kind of holding court where you had, you know, customers of all walks of life coming in for what they needed or just there to kind of, you know, talk and, you know, really play that role of, you know, local grocer where, you know, kind of fast forwarding, you know, ended up working there for close to 3 years, went on to, you know, be one of the managers of the store as well once I was no longer in classes. And it was really powerful to be, you know, directly rooted in this community where I couldn't go, you know, anywhere with getting, you know, waved by somebody where, you know, people would shout out like, hey, it's that produce guy. And, you know, kind of both having that role of community grocer, but then also getting the experience of, you know, being our inventory manager and sort of leading the buying in that space.
I have two questions about that. One is, in that time, what the biggest takeaway about people was, and the second is the biggest takeaway about grocery, you know, about that business or about managing it or even, you know, just inventory. So if you had to sort of sum it up, which is hard, how would you, sum it up?
Yeah, I would say my takeaway about people from that time and experience was the importance of seeing the customer as the individual that they were, and with that meeting them where they were. I think it's, you know, easy enough to, you know, especially coming from a founder's perspective, to think that your product is, you know, the solution for so much or for so many different people, or look at the versatility of my product. And at, you know, the end of the day, you know, a lot of folks just don't have the, you know, the time or resources to, you know, be making these sort of, I don't want to say actively informed decisions, but right. to be considering all of the layers of, you know,
yeah.
of thought and intention
that that's go such into a good
products
one.
That end up on their shelf.
That's such a good one. And I'm going to let you answer the next one, but I do want to just say that that has been for us a massive lesson, because we have these sauces and pouches and we're like, you just squeeze them. You squeeze them on vegetables or tofu or meat or whatever, or bread. But people are, there are, you know, some people look at it and they know exactly what to do with it. And other people really need a lot of guidance. And for the first couple of years, I was like, what do you mean? I don't know how to guide you. You just squeeze it onto chicken, you know, or whatever. But it's a deeper level. I think the way that you're framing it, they don't have the time or resources, it just, or the bandwidth to think about how they want to use it. I'm sure they understand there are many ways to use it, but my job is to take out the thought, like to take out that decision making time. What do I want to do with it? How do I want to use it? I just need to give them like, this is what you do, and that's a huge lesson, and I think one that a lot of us miss. When we think we've come up with a product that is so utilitarian. So I really appreciate that. And it's not just seeing them as the individual from like a customer service or like an appreciating their humanity perspective. It's seeing that they're an individual that has a lot of stuff going on, and they come from different places, or they cook different ways, or they like different things. So adding some sort of decision-making to their day is not necessarily helpful. I'm trying to empower people by letting them make what they want. But in doing that, sometimes I'm kind of causing anxiety, which is like my nightmare. So that's a great point. Okay. And then learned about grocery.
Takeaways about grocery. So I would say kind of, my experience of managing that space, Open Produce, was in part a discovery on my own end of understanding the, you know, sort of role and power that I had as a buyer on the kind of buy demand side.
Yeah.
And with that, you know, it's one thing to say that, like, yes, we have the, you know, the power of the purchase order as a buyer and, you know, able to, you know, sort of make decisions and curate, you know, a product assortment for the customer. But with that, you know, just being very humble about the, you know, the kind of the role in scale of what that purchasing power look like in the context of, you know, a small community market. And at the time, you know, there really was only one other kind of big box store that was located a couple of blocks away. And, you know, it was really impactful and important to, you know, listen to customers, understand what they were, you know, having to walk those extra two or three blocks for, was there a way that I could, you know, find and bring that? So, you know, we could be that destination for the customer. But then also with that, that, you know, I was a small wholesale customer.
Yeah.
I didn't have any sort of, you know, preferential or tiered pricing with, you know, our distributor partners. I would, you know, oftentimes make early morning runs to the, you know, kind of the cash and carry in town to be able to, you know, stock up on certain products. Would even, you know, honestly do some retail arbitrage where like I knew the best deals for 10 for 10 box cereal, like all around, and being able to, you know, bring that into the store and have a accessible like price point on Cheerios.
Right.
And so, you know, really starting to just begin to even scratch the surface on the, you know, financial realities of not just, you know, managing category performance, but end of the day, it was also, you know, running a small business,
right?
That, you know, was in a evolving and gentrifying kind of area. And, you know, today now within 1 mile radius of that store, there is a Whole Foods. Right. They brought in a Target. I think they just brought in a Trader Joe's as well, too, after that other big box store I mentioned kind of went away. And, mm-hmm. you know, I remain in contact with the owner, dear friend.
Open Produce is still rocking and rolling.
It's still there, kind of holding its spot there on the corner. And, I think it speaks to the both the connection and, sort of roots that we built in the community there.
Yeah.
And, that just as we were talking about before, that, consumers don't have the capacity to, be thinking through every single decision of what they're adding to their basket. There are folks too that, have that privilege of time and, are very intentional of who they, look to support, whether it's on the brand or the retailer side. And
right.
those are important relationships to cultivate as well too.
Yeah. How did you end up at Good Eggs? Did you go out back to San Francisco, or did you how did that happen?
Yeah. So kind of after my 5 years, there on the South Side in Hyde Park, my last year in Chicago, I had actually moved out of the neighborhood to the North Side. And for that year, I worked as a butcher, mm-hmm. Which was, really great, and was, kind of having had my experience on the kind of like grocery and retailer side, wanted to continue to develop, just hands-on experience, kind of have that change of pace. Was fortunate enough to work for a shop called Publican Quality Meats, mm-hmm. which is part of a much larger hospitality group there in Chicago. Chicago is an incredible, food city and stop. And with that, having the, opportunity to, work in a high output commercial kitchen where, we were doing prep and processing for an entire family of restaurants. And got to both learn the kind of the skills and anatomy on the butcher side. And with that, it was exciting, but I realized it wasn't something that, I was trying to do for the long run. And,
right.
At that point, I was also, kind of freshly out of a relationship and knew that mm-hmm. it was time to, kind of make a change, as well as, really, evaluating where I was at,
with
professionally,
your life, right.
within my career, within my life.
right.
Again, I didn't have a degree to necessarily fall back on. And, there was a lot of, kind of intentionality and hustle that went into, just being able to make ends meet. And with that, I definitely saw this opportunity to return to grocery. It was what I loved, and, saw this opportunity at this point, we're talking 2015, right. around, the intersection of food and technology.
Yeah.
And so I had cast a very wide net in terms of, opportunities or, potential companies that would work for, or even regions that I would end up.
Right.
Most of the activity was in New York or the Bay Area. And so I was fortunate enough to, secure the job and opportunity at Good Eggs. And that was actually what brought me back to the Bay Area. So I started the day after I returned. I was crashing on a friend's couch at the time. And kind of, the last 5 years have, gone by quickly, but it's been an incredible experience, especially in terms of my, own growth and having right. that, front row seat for a company that's in a really emerging space.
Crazy. All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about all the things founders you should not do when you are engaging with buyers, and a few things that you should do, right, Corey? All right,
yes.
We'll be right back.
Sounds good.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN can provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new shows.
I'm back with Corey Rateau, Senior Category Manager at Good Eggs. Okay. So you've been there for 5 years. I'm gathering that for the most part, you've had a good time. I'm kind of curious about, you know, just sort of the 30,000 foot up view. I mean, clearly COVID, I would imagine, has accelerated sort of everyone's comfort level with e-com and fresh food being delivered that way. I would imagine that the Bay Area was probably readier for it, let's say, than other places. But I'm just kind of curious, over the past 5 years, your thoughts about the general direction of grocery and, you know, just kind of how you think about it, you know?
Absolutely. So yeah, I would say that definitely, you know, the industry has been moving online, and as you called out, comfort level, especially around fresh perishables, you know, remains one of the, as I understand, you know, kind of, you know, top, you know, barriers for right. consumer crossover there, you know, that you'd desire like to you know, be able to pick out your perfect avocado. Yep. Also, you know, there is something to be said about the experience of being in a retail store and, you know, kind of having that discovery and being able to, you know, to walk around. When you look at a retailer like Trader Joe's, where, you know, maybe, you know, you can't do your full grocery shop there necessarily, but it is one of those places that folks get excited to go back to whenever, even if it's just once a month, because there's always going to be something, you know, new and exciting. Right. And I think, you know, that sort of discovery element is something that e-commerce is, you know, very well primed for in terms of the additional real estate, the, you know, ability to incorporate rich media to, you know, really, you know, storytell and bring brands to life in a way that you can't necessarily connect with the customer, you know, when you have placement just on, yeah. you know, a kind of brick and mortar retail shelf.
Yeah, even even as much as like, you know, I mean, we're not on Good Eggs in parentheses yet, .. But, you know, on Fresh Direct on the East Coast, one of the things that's cool is like, they can put scallops and parsley and our Romesco sauce together in a little, you know, visual, and you can add all three to your cart in a way where in a physical store, you'd have to go from one side of the store to get the scallops to the other side of the store to get the parsley to, you know, they're actually, it's storytelling, but it's also like, because grocery stores are so segmented and sort of siloed, e-commerce, I think they have a way of kind of bundling everything in a much more sort of like, I don't know, it's like intuitive way for someone online to shop. And I mean, do you agree? Is that sort of part of what you guys
absolutely the you know the ability to you know cross sell, recommend, really build up those baskets, but then also going back to what we were talking about before, you know, reduce that sort of that friction or kind of the added thought that would go into the customer ultimately deciding to make that purchase decision.
Right.
And kind of as you had mentioned in pointing briefly to COVID, while it's been definitely a whirlwind year for all the many reasons, it has accelerated that timeline for consumer adoption of online. But I think a lot of that has been, whether it's focused on the convenience or, of safety of not having to go into retail stores.
Yeah.
And, with that, I think a lot of the, the discovery, the storytelling, kind of the places beyond just the, convenience or, technology that can make e-commerce, a successful and viable, sales channel. Those are the aspects that get me excited and, look to, really grow and develop win-win partnerships with, producer partners that I'm definitely eager to, get back to. And I want to say that, a kind of a more normal world, but at least one where we aren't all, constantly,
feeling
like we're just like sprinting and, just trying to, backfill gaps or chase down supply chain issues.
Well, I like the way that you said win-win partnerships, because I think this is kind of what I was sort of alluding to, at the beginning that, I think part of, I've been fortunate early on in this whole sort of retail ride to understand, truly understand that, what the role of the brand is and what the role of the buyer is at the store, and that it can't be one-sided, that it has to be a true partnership. It has to be a real relationship, and it has to be win-win for it to work. And I guess I'm just kind of curious about, how do you see brands, I'm sure you get a lot of incoming, right? And you're not going to say yes to, I would imagine, half, but you can tell me if there's a better number. So what is it that you see early on? Obviously aside from like a really good product, but there are a lot of really good products. Like, what is it that you see early on that sort of indicates to you that there will be a true partnership there? What can we do as brands to sort of indicate that we understand and we want to work with you? And, what are the promising signs that you see early on?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess kind of to help provide a little bit more context to my response for folks that aren't familiar with Good Eggs, we are a regional online grocer that currently is operating exclusively in the San Francisco Bay Area. And so with that, we have a single warehouse in West Oakland. And from there, we are, delivering direct to consumer, kind of within essentially a 2-hour radius of that warehouse. And so while we're able to, serve the greater part of the Bay Area, we're not drop shipping, have very much a regional focus alongside with a, sort of limited assortment approach that very much focuses on kind of local small and medium scale producers. And that is something that, has long been in the DNA of the company and, really sort of speaks back to our, early days in founding, because Good Eggs has been around for over 7 years now.
Right.
And kind of before we had a more traditional kind of wholesale, home delivery model, the platform essentially started as a two-sided marketplace. So, like an Etsy for local food producers.
Right.
And with that, it was always with the, sort of express you know, goal and mission of how to reduce the friction for, you know, these small mm-hmm. or B brands, or especially, you know, like kind of growers and ranchers, where, you know, they can focus on what they do best, and that is creating, you know, incredible high quality, you know, products. And how can we take out, you know, sort of the additional logistics and, you know, overhead to, you know, yeah. really, you know, sort of reestablish and reevaluate the value chain.
Yeah.
And so, you know, kind of, and that's your question around, you know, sort of promising signs and, you know, opportunities for, you know, the folks that do, you know, present to us, where that will, you know, go out and discover and look to, you know, bring into the marketplace mm-hmm. is, you know, seeing the role that a single, you know, regional distribution point that a brand like Good Eggs can provide for, you know, an emerging brand. Mm-hmm. That's an incredible, you know, opportunity and a responsibility that myself and my team take very seriously. I also acknowledge that, you know, we aren't a silver bullet. And, you know, as you said, we don't have the ability to support everyone. And then, you know, also with that is, you know, being very candid. And if you are a, you know, a business or brand who is, you know, sees, you know, Good Eggs or any, you know, single retail, you know, partnership as, right. you know, being essential for your business, right. that's a definite, you know, sort of, you know, red flag.
Right.
And, you know, would have me question, like, you know, do you have the ability to, you know, scale and grow right. with us? You know, sort of what other, you know, kind of proof points of, you know, customer market fit do you have, you know, to kind of point to? And so being able to, you know, really take the time to, you know, connect and understand where, you know, upstart, you know, brands are at. And if we can be a part of that, like, solution and their success story, that's really exciting. But then, you know, kind of, I'm sure you've covered this on the show before, you know, the importance of, you know, just kind of having all your, you know, your ducks in a row and, you know, having something that is, you know, retail ready right. that, well, you know, has a clear kind of, yeah, let's pause.
Because, no, I mean, because I have probably covered it, but, you know, there's always a new listener. Because, you know, I think we all think we have our ducks in a row and then we're like, oh, wait, that's what he meant by ducks in a row. So, you know, when you say retail ready, like, I mean, do you have a checklist, for example, or is it more just sort of, you know, qualitative, not quantitative for you guys? Like, do they need to have certifications of some sort? Do you need to know where they're producing, and do they need, you know, like, are there actual ducks in a row that make someone retail ready, as opposed to, like, I made this really great jam and I think you should sell it?
Absolutely. One second, I can speak to, you know, some or the kind of specifics or what, at least in the context of Good Eggs, our sort of checklist is. But, you know, for me, when I think retail ready, I would say the kind of the most important piece of the equation for me is, you know, is a founder with a product, you know, truly understanding where their product kind of, like, what their price slope is, and, you know, kind of, are they taking into consideration, you know, overhead, you know, promotional trade spend, you right. know, even if you are a small brand, like, those are elements that ultimately, you know, ladder and add up to, you know, sort of to your cost, and having visibility, you know, into that and realizing it and like, okay, yes, I do need to allocate a certain percentage towards, you know, promotional spend. Right. And what is the cost of, you know, my, you know, shipping and packaging if I'm, you know, doing direct to consumer on e-commerce.
Right.
I think that's really important because, you know, the second that you're going with a, you know, want to sell a jam for $8, but then, you know, kind of 6 months, 18 months down the line, you realize that you actually have a $12 jam.
Right.
That's going to be really difficult because, you know, ultimately as a category manager, you know, I'm also really responsible for the financial performance of, you know, our marketplace. And with that, a, you know, $8 jam plays a different role within a product set than a $12 jam.
Right.
And so, yeah, I would say that is, I think, the most important, you know, kind of advice and, you know, sort of at least starting point for, I believe, a brand to start engaging with retail buyers.
Because I imagine, I think when I'm sort of thinking about who I'm speaking to, I'm thinking about someone who has a good product, but is getting ready to go onto the shelf. But actually, I'm also now speaking to, more than I was before, people with successful digitally native products that are now trying to figure out the wholesale world. And I see more and more brands kind of coming to the conclusion. I mean, just like we came to the conclusion that we need to have a direct channel, and now you can buy us directly from us, which I would not have thought a year ago, to be clear. Digitally native brands are thinking like, okay, this is great. I'm making money, but I do need to be in stores for a number of reasons. And the numbers are different. And I think, you know, I've talked to a bunch of people and they're kind of like, wait, the distributor makes what? And then you have a broker too. And then you need to go on promotion how many times a year? And then you need to do free fills and what? Like, and it can sound like a lot, you know, it whittles away. Which kind of goes back to just having good unit economics so that you're not, you know, if you have already a pretty, you know, low product margin, you're going to end up spending so much in trade and distribution that it's going to be hard for you not to keep continually having to go out and raise money. And that is exhausting and it's hard and it whittles away at your ownership. So for a number of reasons, I think for, you know, in terms of presenting to someone like you, it's good to have those ducks in a row, but just those are also just good business fundamentals. And then absolutely. in terms of promoting, you know, our buyer from Fresh Direct ended up coming and is now our brand director at Haven's Kitchen. So we often joke about how she was like, you should probably consider a promotion. And I was like, no, you know, if you're a good brand, you don't need to promote. She's like, no, it's actually just like what you do to get people to try your product who aren't necessarily willing to spend $6 like to try something they've never had before. So when she put it in that context, it made more sense. But do you find yourself explaining this a lot to people? Like, do you find yourself sort of like trying to explain why people need to promote or why a price won't work as great as your thing is? No one wants to pay $15 for it, that kind of thing. Or are the brands a little bit more, I guess, sophisticated by the time they come to you?
That's a great question. And before I lose the thought, the one thing I did want to, you know, comment, and I think you said was spot on, is, you know, the importance of just having, you know, good unit economics and business fundamentals, where I think there is a, you know, kind of a fallacy in that, you know, sort of scenario you presented of, you know, having to constantly go out and, continue mm-hmm. to raise or dilute equity in your company is thinking that at scale,
right,
the unit economics will work.
They don't.
Because it's a definitely a red flag. If they don't at where you are now, they aren't necessarily going to go
right.
in the future.
I know.
And in terms of, you know, sort of brands' understanding and expectations around promotions, mm-hmm. it's definitely a mixed bag. I think it's less so the, you know, needing to explain, like, this is the importance of promotions. Mm-hmm. It is more the, you know, sort of working with a brand to really get to the, you know, understand the objective of what that promotion or, you know, yes, you have now allocated for trade spend, but what are you looking to accomplish?
Right.
And, you know, kind of that definitely varies on a, you know, a category by category basis. So if you are looking at, you know, a more kind of crowded category, you know, say yogurt or bars, you know, places that, you know, it may not be as big of a, you know, sort of a retail price jump for the customer. Discovery plays a huge role.
Right.
You know, or, you know, if you are in a, you know, I'm gonna say a slower turning category where, you know, if you're selling olive oil, like, no, you shouldn't have the expectation that you're going to see, you know, like weekly repurchase rates, but, you know, right. what cadence are customers buying your product? Are they, you know, the types that are, you know, buying, you know, specifically when something is on promo, and, you know, is it less about, you know, discovery as opposed to, you know, sort of being able to just like hold and maintain your, you know, kind of the market share that you've carved out in that category.
And I think that's a really good, you know, it's so funny how like all of these points kind of interconnect. And I think this is why I have so much fun in this business and so much fun talking to people like you, because, you know, one of the things we talk about also is like, again, we're so smitten with our own products. We are. We're so in love with them, and we should be, because I mean, for God's sake, like if we're not, then why would we be doing this? But we forget to look around sometimes, and we forget to look at like, and it's like, you got to look at who else is on the shelf with you. You got to look at like when you're, if you're about to pitch someone like Corey, you have to look at Good Eggs and see like where would you fall? Like what category are you in? Where, if you search what would come up? Like all of these things are critical because it allows you to sort of levels, you know, like benchmark yourself against other brands. Even if you're not getting a ton of data from the expensive data people, you can still have an idea of other, you know, other people's price points, other people's keywords, how often other, you know, other brands in your category promote. I mean, would it be reasonable for someone to ask you sort of like what your expected velocity should be for that category? Is that the kind of information that you would give to a brand?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And I'm like looking over the notes that I took in. Mm-hmm. Literally, like you just quoted me word for word. Like
I did?
I love that. Around the question of what brand behavior really annoys you.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say, you know, asking about, you know, velocity. You know, I think that is a really, you know, kind of spot on, you know, question for, you know, a brand to have or, you know, ask a retailer. You're always going to, you know, get some sort of feel like kind of big or, you know, condition
right.
sort of response, but that is the piece that, you know, even if you do your research, just as you described of, you know, understanding your competitors, your comps, where would you fall in this marketplace? You know, that is the sort of, you know, insight that you won't necessarily have, you know, maybe if you, you know, as you mentioned, had access to SPINS or other, you know, syndicated yeah. data, but ultimately, you know, if you make that connection, develop those inroads with the buyer, that is how you will begin to understand, okay, you know, I am pitching this, you know, this buyer with, you know, sort of my perspective, and understand that it's not just about, you know, this is why my product is so amazing, right, but this is the, you know, role I could see it fitting within your marketplace.
Right.
And, you know, kind of what as a buyer would you consider to be, you know, successful within this category? What are you looking for?
Right.
Less so on the, like, what is your margin target here? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, no, I'm not, you know, pricing to a fixed rate, and, you right. know, I'm having to think about retail price points, not just on your product, but across, like, you know, a full, you know, range or within that category. But really understanding, you know, the buyer's definition of success, because right. that is the, you know, the sort of the foundation of that win-win partnership, of making sure that y'all are in alignment of what you're looking to accomplish, you know, by having placement in that store.
And I think, you know, it goes back to sort of like a true relationship, right? Like, if you don't ask someone on the other side of the relationship what success looks like to them, and you're only kind of thinking about what success looks like to you, it's kind of unlikely that you're going to have a successful relationship, right? Like, it has to be mm-hmm. two-sided in that sense. And I guess that were there other, I did send you that question ahead of time, like, any other brand behavior that really annoys you?
Definitely the, like, you know, trying to, you know, ask about margin rates and targets. Mm-hmm. You know, at the end of the day, you can, if you know your competitors, you see where they're at on the shelf, like, that can help you understand that landscape. You know, the other thing that comes to mind, and just because it is that season, is, you know, have realistic expectations and timelines of engaging with buyers, especially around, you know, Q4.
Right.
We are, you know, both constantly, you know, like, evaluating things, but we're also, you know, like, we're executing, you know, our retail strategy is running holidays. And I think it's not to be discouraging to brands, but, you know, like, kind of how do you use that time and period to really, you know, look inward and, you know, be ready at the top of the year to, you know, go full force.
So that's great advice. I mean, I'm going to just sum that up a little bit, because it's, you know, it's November now. So my guess is that for those of you who are looking to meet new buyers and get buyer meetings right now, between now and the end of the year, you're probably going to be disappointed is kind of, I think, the gist. That being said, this is a great opportunity, almost the way that COVID has been a great opportunity, to really kind of figure out your business, look at your team, look at where you're spending money, look at the direction where you want to go, look at your flavors and your SKU assortment, and decide, like, you know, is there one of them that you love, but it's just not pulling its weight? Like, this is the time to kind of get your stuff all tightened up so that you can hit the ground running in the beginning of 2021 with a really great deck and, you know, a really strong team and all of those decisions kind of made. It's kind of fun if you think about it. Like I was saying to Jess before you came on, I was exposed to someone who has COVID. So I'm now in quarantine for 2 weeks. And after my initial sort of like freak out, now I'm like, okay, well, I can't do anything outside of my house for 2 weeks. So how am I going to use this 2 weeks to just like clean out every closet and cook everything I've ever wanted to experiment with, because I'm alone and I can just try everything? Like what are the things that, you know, I'm going to clean the bookshelf, you know, like, and it's kind of similar, like use this time as a time to really figure out your business so that you can like go out there. And when they do go out there, what's your favorite way, or what do you find the best way for founders and salespeople to communicate with you without sort of harassing you? I will say, and I mean this with love, buyers are not all that responsive. And I don't think we ever want to be like, hey, it's me again. Hey, just reaching out. But like, is there a way to communicate with buyers that elicits a response without being annoying? Or is it just like, get used to it, keep trying?
I mean, there's something, yes, to be said about persistence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, also realizing to the, you know, the kind of volume of, you know, kind of inbound requests and, you know, just, you know, products that are out there.
Right.
I would say, you know, one of the most, you know, successful or, you know, kind of promising sources for new relationships, you know, comes from referrals that, you know, are coming from other producers that are already in our marketplace. And I, you know, would say both in terms of what you were just talking on, like, you know, how can you really, you know, double down, use these, you know, kind of moments of maybe, you know, slowness to really, you know, strengthen your brand is the importance of, you know, networking, engaging, and being part of, you know, this producer community. And so that's why I'm really grateful to contribute to, you know, resources like this show, because, you know, those are the sort of the networks that, you know, will allow you to, you know, connect and engage with buyers in a meaningful way.
Yeah.
And
that's a great point too. And I think when you're, you know, I know whenever I've asked someone to sort of put in a good word with a buyer, it's kind of like if you ask someone to write you a recommendation letter, you kind of write the bullets out yourself so that it makes it very easy for them to sort of forward. Hey, I love this soda. It's got no sugar. It's got these flavors, the founder, and they're doing great at you know, and it just, it makes it so much easier for another brand to send that on to someone like you, Corey, right? So that getting that kind of organized ahead of time, instead of like, hey, do you know the guy at, you know, Good Eggs? Can you just like, can you put in a good word for me? Like, that's not going to work as well. I mean, it will maybe work. The guy's a really good friend of yours, but it'll make it a little harder for that person to do you the favor quickly and easily. Last question. Mm-hmm. If you, I'm just picturing you sometimes like at your desk and being like, I wish I could just tell, you know, like get like a bullhorn and tell brands this, like something we don't know or we underestimate or we just don't have insight into that you just wish we would all know. Is there anything? This is your chance. This is your bullhorn.
I think we've, you know, covered so much in the last hour, and I'm trying to think of, like, you know, kind of, are there any things that I want to, you know, elevate or circle back to? And, you know, as that question was framed, I would say that at least within, you know, my role and for my team, you know, the kind of two primary metrics that we are responsible for is, you know, our average order size and, you know, gross margin. Okay. And so, you know,
that's helpful.
While those are the sort of, you know, the quantifiable metrics of, you know, how we're being evaluated, you know, there is also all of the work that goes into, you know, not just achieving those goals, but, you know, starting with developing our category strategy, you know, understanding our priorities, especially as a marketplace that is still, you know, rapidly growing, where over the last, you know, 3+ years, you know, my team and I have, you know, added thousands of SKUs, but with that, we are, you know, both constantly refining within like specific categories, expanding into new ones, you know, backfilling and, you know, chasing down and actually having to come up with the solution for, mm-hmm. oh no, there's no toilet paper. Like, how do we get toilet paper?
Yeah.
And, you know, understanding that the sort of the engagement that, you know, founders may be having with, you know, their retail partners, that is only a, you know, like one aspect of the job and function.
Yep.
And, you know, going back to, you know, you were talking about like, what are those bullet points? What is the role that, you know, I could see my product playing in, you know, in this marketplace?
Yeah.
And not just because, you know, your product is infinitely versatile. It's, you know, either you know, see that you have a clear, you know, kind of space or gap within their existing assortment, or, you know, can hone in on, hey, I think, like, you know, this is an opportunity if we, you know, present the product in this way, or, you know, like, kind of, this is where I would like to focus on, you know, on growing sales and, you know, meeting a potential consumer need based off of, you know, what we've learned from our engagement with, with brands or with the consumer. And the last thing I will say on that note as well, too, is whether you're starting, you know, from, they're like, you know, direct to consumer and then looking to make that cut over to e-commerce, or as I sort of picked up from you, kind of maybe, you know, adding in direct to consumer, you know, after having a, you know, a presence in retail brick and mortar, is, you know, just because with, you know, online or, you know, drop shipping, you're able to connect to, you know, a much broader, you know, kind of consumer base, is that even digitally native brands, I believe it's important to really, you know, focus on regionality and locality, where, you know, being able to, you know, point to and say that, hey, I'm based in New York, but, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area, like, is an established market for us. You know, like, could we, you know, like, looking to explore having more of a retail presence there. And oftentimes I feel like there is the sort of inverse expectation or hope on the brand side, especially when I'm engaging with folks that are not exclusively local, where they're like, oh, wow, this would be like the perfect opportunity for us to have presence in, you know, the Bay Area.
Yep.
And
no, that's a great point. Yeah. You don't, I mean, you don't want to be the ticket. You want to be supportive, but you don't want to be, it's like what you said earlier, you don't want to be the end all be all in that place. That makes a lot of sense. Corey, thank you so much. We got a lot in here. I mean, all brands have to do is just listen to this and then they'll just get into every store, everywhere they go. No, this was amazing. Thank you so much. Thank you for being my 100th guest. Jess, thank you for engineering. I'm sorry. I'm not good at time management when it comes to this. And all of you listeners out there, it's just so much fun hearing from all of you. I don't know how I got so lucky to be doing what I'm doing, but I'm so grateful. And you're all a big part of it. And it's fun talking to you and helping you. And just keep on growing, get your ducks in a row, and hit the ground running. We have a bunch more episodes this year. And I will be back next week with another episode of In the Sauce. Thanks, Corey.
Thank you so much, Ali. It was a real pleasure speaking with you. Be well now.
In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.